Libertarians, though perhaps too few of us, often say that the absolutely most important issue for them is foreign policy. For many of us, especially recent generations, this is the touchstone subject that either converted us to libertarianism or made us into radicals, maybe both. Surely all of us are familiar, though, with the most common response to libertarian visions of foreign affairs. The United States is an exceptional nation with an indispensable role to play in the world. Well, we've toyed with the concept of exceptionalism before, and now Cato's own Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies, Chris Preble, joins us to discuss U.S. foreign policy in its broad scope. Welcome to Liberty Chronicles, a project of libertarianism.org. I'm Anthony Comegna. So the revolutionary and the founding generation, they are famed for having read their history thoroughly and very well.
Yes.
In the
original Greek.
Yeah. Many of them at least,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. And they were very familiar with history, English history, ancient history. It meant a lot to them. And I think there was a real sense that they were making history. That they were agents of change for the world,
yes,
and its course. Could you explain to us how the revolutionary and the founding generations thought of themselves as agents of history?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me, Anthony. I think that they had a very clear sense that the world was watching, or at least they wanted the world to be watching. And you see this, you know, in Declaration of Independence and a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. They were fashioning a new system, a new political system, and they were so determined to be different from the, you know, kings and princes of their ancestors. And one of the key themes that emerges all along is this sense that preparing for war or you know, having to arm to defend oneself was a vehicle for the growth of the state. And they were very, you know, again, they're not naive. They recognized that they needed to actually fight to secure their independence from Great Britain. But they were always mindful that that could get out of control. And so they were, they were just constantly struggling with this, right? They were very, for example, famously sort of wary of permanent standing armies. On the other hand, they recognized their need. So it really was a balancing act right from the very beginning.
There was, and you know, to go along with their sort of enlightenment study of history, they also had a powerful sense of religious mission that was long rooted in American history.
Right.
How does the sense of mission interact with this sense of history?
Well, they absolutely did have a sense of history. We as historians have sort of looked backwards a bit too much, perhaps, and sort of famously reached back to John Winthrop's speech in which he talks about the city on a hill. It's not obvious that the founders were as aware of Winthrop as we were, but they had a general sense that by creating something like a new Jerusalem, like a new promised land, that would be an example to others. That's part of why they wanted to be different, to not just be a better version of the predecessors, but something that was founded on core principles of individual liberty and freedom. Again, you know, there are multiple sort of problems and contradictions, you know, not the least of which is slavery and things like that. But there were obviously some key differences in terms of how they organized themselves politically and the importance of citizen representation and all those sorts of things.
Now, it seems if you mix a religious sense of mission mm-hmm. with an Enlightenment, liberal, secular study of history, you might well get something that turns out to look a lot like 19th century Manifest Destiny.
Right. Yes. Right? Yes.
This sense that history itself is doing the mission making, not necessarily God, although, you know, by the time of Manifest Destiny in the 1840s, plenty of people, perhaps even more people than in the revolutionary generation, had this revived religious sense of mission guiding them. But let's talk about foreign policy then, since your book is all about foreign policy. Let's talk about foreign policy in the early republic after independence has been secured from Britain, and Americans now do have this unique opportunity to enter into the national stage.
Right.
What do they do with it?
Well, the first thing they do, of course, is after the revolution and after, you know, winning victory in the war, they stumble along for a little while under the Articles of Confederation. And one of the key sort of factors driving the move to create a stronger and federal state was a concern about foreign threats. In particular, of course, they worried about the individual states fighting with one another. They worried about internal rebellion as a threat to the individual states less capable. And so there's no question that part of the rationale for the Constitution is driven by fears of foreign threats and the ability of foreign states to sort of pick these individual states apart one by one and set them against one another. But it's also true that from Washington on down, that once they had created this more perfect union, right, a tighter union of states, they still wanted very much for the United States to remain separate as much as possible from the disputes of the European powers. Yes, they relied upon in the case of the French for the Revolution, and then there was obviously a lot of tension between how much to ally with the French versus the British in the early days of the early republic, but they were equally committed to trade as an engine for not just prosperity but also for good relations with other countries. So I think even in the very early days, you see this willingness to interact with others and a real wariness of being drawn into other people's fights.
Yeah, you know, it struck me while you were saying that this is how Douglas North won his Nobel Prize, right? Wasn't it for his work on economic history, right?
I think that's right. Yeah.
I think so. That book on early American economic history, where he said it was trade that built the American economy. At least it was the basis,
correct,
for the kinds of investments in an industry that boomed it later. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you have essentially a second rate power trying to get wealthier, or in the case of North, he was saying this is a model for the third world today, the so-called
Correct.
Third world,
yes.
The developing world.
Developing world. We were a developing country, obviously, in the early days, and we behaved like a developing country.
Yeah, it's this ragtag second-rate power trying to maintain its very newly won independence from these great globe-spanning empires.
Right.
The greatest power the world had seen from the British Empire, and its politics, even domestic politics in the 1790s, are basically dictated by this conflict between Britain and France.
Correct. This is something that comes through. It comes through quite clearly in Washington's farewell address, but you see it in other ways as well. They were so concerned about attachments to foreign countries tearing the country apart, and there was definitely a fear and a legitimate fear about that in the late 1700s, precisely because of this dispute between Britain and France. But those concerns persisted, and I think again the ability of the United States to form together in union depended upon individual members of, you know, sort of citizens, Republicans, small r, to be so focused on the U.S. Position and improving oneself, improving the country, without having to rely on a foreign protector or a foreign patron, right? It was about reciprocity and dealing equally with as many countries as possible.
Now, dealing with as many countries as possible, I was about to ask you. I would consider the American dealings with Native Americans, a matter of foreign policy.
Yes.
But that is not, generally speaking, how people at the time treated it.
Correct.
Especially after independence, when these are considered, you know, dependent peoples, basically, within the jurisdiction of the United States. Did anybody at the time consider that their interactions with the Indians a interaction with a foreign people, or was this idea of Indians as dependents on this new nation, was that around in the 1790s?
That's a really good question.
Washington was still destroying towns.
It's a really good question. Obviously, there were moments in early American history in the colonial era where the various Native American nations were dealt with as sometime allies, right? And the British did this as well, and the French did this. It was, you know, a fair amount of realpolitik in dealing with these various groups. I do think eventually the American government's position towards the Native Americans shifted away from seeing them as sovereign peoples to dependents. I can't really say where we would fix on that particular time when that occurred, but certainly one of the great ironies, let me back up for a minute, because one of the great ironies, and I talk about this in the book, is that one of the grievances that the colonists had against the British was the line of control, which basically prevented the European, mostly British settlers from moving farther west. Again, partly because the British had made certain promises to the Native Americans who had cooperated with them against the French in Seven Years' War, as we know, the French and Indian War. And so after the Revolution and after independence, the Native American tribes would certainly have looked upon the American colonists as more rapacious and aggressive colonizers than the British were. And so that's one of those ironies of American history. And of course, I think you're absolutely right that in the course of the 19th century, as the United States expanded from the Atlantic all the way to the Pacific, those actions would look to any other outside observer as though it were foreign policy. And I think as a historian of U.S. history, I think over time, historians have come to that point of view. I don't think the American people, many of them, think of it that way. But it comes up today in the present era because people compare, for example, U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq as synonymous with U.S. involvement against the Sioux or the Cherokee. And I think that's apples and radiators. It's not even apples to oranges. It's so different. And I do try to talk about that a little bit in the book. It's about, you know, how you define your security perimeter, what's required to be secure and prosperous. And, you know, it's at least a debatable proposition that the United States could have tolerated an independent sovereign people who would always be at risk, or there would always be a danger that those independent sovereign people could ally with a foreign power or something like that. And I think that's a lot of what drove American expansion, territorial expansion, throughout the 19th century.
Now, the most famous American Indian warrior is no doubt Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
But John Quincy Adams,
who
really,
I don't think makes an appearance in this book, and that's probably not by accident.
But John Quincy Adams,
not a libertarian.
Oh no. but it was John Quincy Adams that really started the Indian removal policy that Jackson was so famous for implementing, along with Van Buren. But Adams is also probably the best representative of the strain of enlightenment that you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
And this special American reverence for republicanism and for especially their independence from Britain as a world-changing event. And this is going to be our first document here. And I wondered if you could just set it up for us by telling us a bit about Adams and his position in the United States and his position in the world.
Right.
Because he was an exceptionally worldly American.
He was an exceptionally worldly American, and a person who, as a very young man, was sent with his father, you know, as initially sort of as a personal secretary to his father, as an emissary to England, to Europe as the war is going on, and then sent to St. Petersburg. So this was a man who, before he completed high school, would have had more diplomatic experience than nearly anyone, you know, twice or three times his age even. And he just sort of continued in that mode throughout early adulthood. And so by the time he gives this famous speech in 1821 on July 4th, he was already well established as a philosopher, as a statesman, and of course had been or was at the time serving as Monroe's Secretary of State. He had secured recently a treaty with has his name on it, the Adams-Onis Treaty, that's basically resolved Spanish Florida as an American possession, so he did have a unique standing by the time he gave this speech, and then it was several years later, of course, he'd be elected president in his own right. I was aware of this speech. It has been elements of this speech have been used over and over again. It was sort of famously invoked by George Kennan in a article in Foreign Affairs many years ago, but just the one small part, "America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy." When I finally had a chance to read this speech in its entirety, it is practically life-changing. I mean, this man, he was obviously entertaining an audience, and this was this is what they did back then, right? They gave speeches and they listened to speeches, and that was part of it. But it's so rich. There's so much more to this talk than just that famous line. And I encourage everyone who hasn't had a chance to give it a second look, or maybe a first look for many people.
Fellow citizens, until within a few days before that which we have again assembled to commemorate our fathers, the people of the Union had constituted a portion of the British nation, a nation renowned in the arts and arms, who, from a small island in the Atlantic Ocean, had extended their dominion over considerable parts of every quarter of the globe, governed themselves by a race of kings, whose title to sovereignty had originally been founded on conquest, spellbound for a succession of ages, under that portentous system of despotism and of superstition, which in the name of the meek and humble Jesus had been spread over the Christian world. The history of this nation had, for a period of 700 years, from the days of the conquest till our own, exhibited a conflict almost continued between the oppressions of power and the claims of right. In the theories of the crown and the mitre, man had no rights. Neither the body nor the soul of the individual was his own. From the impenetrable gloom of this intellectual darkness and the deep degradation of this servitude, the British nation had partially emerged. The martyrs of religious freedom had consumed to ashes at the stake, the champions of temporal liberty had bowed their heads upon the scaffold, and the spirits of many a bloody day had left their earthly vesture upon the field of battle and a sword to plead the cause of liberty before the throne of heaven. Through long ages of civil war, the people of Britain had extorted from their tyrants not acknowledgments but grants of right. With this concession, they had been content to stop in the progress of human improvement. They received their freedom as a donation from their sovereigns. They appealed for their privilege to a sign manual and a seal. They held their title to liberty, like their title to lands, from the bounty of a man in their moral and political chronology. The Greater Charter of Runnymede was the beginning of the world. Fellow citizens, it was in the heat of this war of moral elements which brought on Stuart to the block and hurled another from his throne, that our forefathers sought refuge from its fury in the then wilderness of this Western world. They were willing exiles from a country dearer to them than life, but they were the exiles of liberty and of conscience, dearer to them even than their country. They came too with charters from their kings, for even in removing another hemisphere, they cast longing, lingering looks behind, and were anxiously desirous of retaining ties of connection with their country, which in the solemn compact of a charter, they hoped by the corresponding links of allegiance and protection to persevere. But to their sense of right, the charter was only the ligament between them, their country, and their king. Transported to a new world, They had relations with one another and relations with the Aboriginal inhabitants of the country to which they came, for which no royal charter could provide. The first settlers of the Plymouth colony, at the eve of landing from their ship, therefore bound themselves together by a written covenant, and immediately after landing purchased from the Indian natives the right of settlement upon the soil. Thus was a social compact formed upon the elementary principles of civil society, in which conquest and servitude had no part. The slough of brutal force was entirely cast off. All was voluntary. All was unbiased consent. All was the agreement of soul with soul. Other colonies were successively founded, and other charters granted until in the compass of a century and a half, 13 distinct British provinces peopled the Atlantic shores of the North American continent with 2 millions of freemen, possessing by their charters the rights of British subjects and nurtured by their position and education in the more comprehensive and original doctrines of human rights. From their infancy, they had been treated by the parent state with neglect, harshness, and injustice. Their charters had often been disregarded and violated, their commerce restricted and shackled, their interest wantonly or spitefully sacrificed, so that the hand of the parent had been scarcely ever felt, but in the alternate application of whips and scorpions. When, in spite of all these persecutions, by the natural vigor of their constitution, they were just attaining the maturity of political manhood, a British Parliament, in contempt of the clearest maxims of natural equity, in defiance of the fundamental principle upon which British freedom itself had been cemented with British blood, on the naked, unblushing allegation of absolute and uncontrollable power, undertook by their act to levy, without representation and without consent, taxes upon the people of America for the benefit of the people of Britain. This enormous project of public robbery was no sooner made known than excited throughout the colonies one general burst of indignant resistance. It was abandoned, reasserted, and resumed until fleets and armies were transported to record in the characters of fire, famine, and desolation the transatlantic wisdom of British legislation and the tender mercies of British consanguinity. It will be acted o'er fellow citizens, but it can never be repeated. It stands and must forever stand alone, a beacon on the summit of the mountain, to which all the inhabitants of the earth may turn their eyes for a genial and saving light, till time shall be lost in eternity, and this globe itself dissolve, nor leave a wreck behind. It stands forever, a light of admonition to the rulers of men, a light of salvation and redemption to the oppressed. So long as this planet shall be inhabited by human beings, so long as man shall be of social nature, so long as government shall be necessary to the great moral purposes of society, and so long as it shall be abused to the purposes of oppression, so long shall this declaration hold out to the sovereign and to the subject the extent and boundaries of their respective rights and duties, founded in the laws of nature and of nature's God. 45 years have passed away since this declaration was issued by our fathers, and here are we, fellow citizens, assembled in the full enjoyment of its fruits, to bless the author of our being for the counties of his providence, in casting our lot in this favored land, to remember with effusions of gratitude the sages who put forth and the heroes who bled for the establishment of this declaration, and by the communion of soul in the reperusal and hearing of this instrument, to renew the genuine holy alliance of its principles, to recognize them as eternal truths, and to pledge ourselves and bind our posterity to a faithful and undeviating adherence to them. In the progress of 40 years since the acknowledgement of our independence, we have gone through many modifications of internal government and through all the vicissitudes of peace and war with other mighty nations, but never, never for a moment have the great principles consecrated by the declaration of this day been renounced or abandoned. And now, friends and countrymen, if the wise and learned philosophers of the older world, the first observers of the mutation and aberration, the discoverers of maddening ether and invisible planets, the inventors of Congreve rockets and shrapnel shells, should find their hearts disposed to inquire, what has America done for the benefit of mankind? Let our answer be this: America, with the same voice which spoke herself into existence as a nation, proclaimed to mankind the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the only lawful foundations of government. America, in the assembly of nations since her admission among them, has invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. She has uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often to disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, equal justice, and equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when the conflict has been for principles to which she clings as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. She has seen that probably for centuries to come, all the contests of the European world will be contests between inveterate power and emerging right. Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will be her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She will recommend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. The frontlet upon her brows would no longer beam with the ineffable splendor of freedom and independence, but in its stead would soon be submitted an imperial diadem, flashing in false and tarnished luster the murky radiance of dominion and power. She might become dictatoress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler in her own spirit. Stand forth, ye champions of Britannia, ruler of the waves. Stand forth, ye chivalrous knights of chartered liberties and the rotten borough. Enter the lists, ye boaster of inventive genius. Ye mighty masters of the palette and the brush, come and inquire what has America done for the benefit of mankind. In the half century which has elapsed since the Declaration of American Independence, what have you done for the benefit of mankind? We shall not contend with you for the prize of music, painting, or sculpture. We shall not disturb to the ecstatic trances of your chemists, nor call from the heavens the ardent gaze of your astronomers. We will not ask you who was the last president of your Royal Academy. We will not inquire by whose mechanical combinations it was that your steamboats stemmed the currents of your rivers and vanquished the opposition of the winds themselves upon your seas. We will not name the inventor of the cotton gin, for we fear that you would ask us the meaning of the word and pronounce it a provincial barbarism. We will not name to you him whose graver defies the imitation of forgery and saves the labor of your executioner by taking from your greatest geniuses of robbery the power of committing the crime. He is now among yourselves, and since your philosophers have permitted him to prove to them the compressibility of water, you may perhaps claim him for your own. Would you soar to fame upon a rocket, or burst into glory from a shell? We shall leave you to inquire of your naval heroes their opinion of the steam battery and the torpedo. It is not by the contrivance of agents of destruction that America wishes to commend her inventive genius to the admiration or the gratitude of after times, nor is it even by the detection of the secrets or the composition of new modifications of physical nature. Her glory is not dominion, but liberty. Her march is the march of mind. She has a spear and a shield, but the motto upon her shield is freedom, independence, peace. This has been her declaration. This has been, as far as her necessary intercourse with the rest of mankind would permit, her practice.
Now, one of the most famous events of the 1820s, this sounds very bizarre to us today, perhaps, but one of the most famous events was Lafayette's, his famous return tour
to
the United States. Yeah, after independence, sure. It had been 50 years since independence was declared, and Lafayette was returning to party on a giant tour around the United States, and people turned out in huge numbers to see him and to hear him speak and just to celebrate with him. Can you give us a sense of how Americans are thinking about themselves and their place in the world, say from the 1820s on to the 1840s?
Sure. Well, I think that it's absolutely true that after After the Second War of the British, with the British, the War of 1812, they were feeling pretty good about themselves and sort of wind at their backs. And, you know, the world is our oyster, whatever term you want to use, whether a cliche. But there was also hanging over them a sense of the danger that could come from within, right? The danger of slavery in particular and slave power and this concern about maintaining a balance in the political order. And again, Adams, John Quincy Adams was so critical in that during the 1820s. But I think there was this desire to sort of want to believe the best that this country could possibly be, and yet in the background was sort of always this nagging sense that danger was just around the corner. But the danger wasn't coming from outside. The danger was coming from within.
One of the most interesting things I've found too is that there's almost this desperate political rhetoric to try to ramp up the British as still this juggernaut that we have to fear.
Right.
But it doesn't really take hold too deeply.
Right. I mean, look, this is a common practice, right, is that in order to maintain cohesion at home, you invoke fear from abroad or from the other. Now, again, concern about threats within the continental United States from the Native American tribes could represent that sort of threat, and especially along the communities along the on the fringes, so to speak, or along the frontier. But in terms of a large enough and a scary enough threat to maintain cohesion in the more settled places, that was still Great Britain to a large extent. But I think you're right. I think it didn't take in the same way that it did in the early 1800s.
Of course, there were also these interesting, as we've covered a lot on the show, there were these interesting dynamics where a lot of the folks who were anti-war, for example, in the Mexican War, opposed annexing Texas and going to war with Mexico because they didn't want to agitate the slavery issue between
Correct.
The sections.
That's
and
exactly
disrupt
right.
this awful gentleman's agreement not to bring it up.
That's right.
So that, they knew it would, people like Calhoun knew it would disrupt the political class. So he didn't want a war with Mexico if it could be avoided.
Right.
Of course, he didn't have the heart to oppose it once it had started. What do you say about that? That there's also, even in the anti-war streak, there's not necessarily the best of reasons.
Oh, absolutely right. I mean, I think, and this is a theme that is definitely sort of comes up again and again over the course of the 19th century. That on the one hand, you have this sense that the political order is fairly stable, as you say, a sort of gentleman's agreement. Let's not upset the apple cart. On the other hand, from a foreign policy perspective and from a security perspective, you are trying to identify ways to push out the boundaries of the state as a buffer to drive out possible challengers, possible threats. And that's what impels, to a considerable extent, the drive all the way to the Pacific, right? It's just like push off of the continental United States or push down Mexico as a potential threat. But that bumps up against the political dynamic, which, as you noted, if you expand this territory west and south, it is almost certain to be slave states. And so it comes up over and over again. What I was fascinated by, it was one of the first times I'd really looked at this. David Mayers wrote a terrific book about sort of at various stages in American history, the dissenters against expansion. And what struck me was I was aware of the slavery argument and the politics of it. But Mayers makes the point that there was also a sense that this noble experiment depended upon a small state, and that small state couldn't stay small, or it would be difficult for that small state to remain limited if the actual expanse of the territory continued to grow. And this came up even in what most people agree is sort of like, well, a slam dunk, right, was the Louisiana Purchase. Even the Louisiana Purchase, the question was, for a handful of dissenters, the question was, how on earth are we going to maintain a small state that is respectful of individual liberties when we've doubled, more than doubled the size of our territory? And this comes up over and over and over again. So I do think you're absolutely right that the politics of slavery was always an issue, at least through the end of the 19th century, but there was also this sense that there was tension between a classical liberal limited state, enumerated powers, and one that could, whenever it felt like it, grow its actual remit, right, to actually grow the extent of the territory under its control.
Now, I also think that the politics of slavery tend to swallow the narrative of
yes,
that time period.
That's absolutely right. Yep.
And even when foreign policy comes up in, say, the 1850s or the 1860s, when it's, you know, not about the Civil War, foreign policy seems to be about Southerners' attempts to purchase Cuba or, you know, other slaveholding territories,
right.
Islands
right.
in the Caribbean. Yep. And then after the war, it's Alaska, and that's about it. Like, we
right.
purchased Alaska. But I taught in graduate school with the legal and military historian Peter Karsten.
Okay.
And one thing that he would repeatedly argue in the course was that U.S. foreign policy going back very far into the 1840s was mainly about using the Navy to expand markets for American producers.
Right.
And I mean, this goes, you know, things like it usually takes the form of bombarding a coastline, right, with cannons.
Yes, yes.
Like in Japan or Korea.
Yes.
You open—
Or threatening to, right.
Yeah, you open a country by showing them how great your cannons are by throwing a volley off to the sea.
Yes.
a friendly demonstration. Can you give us sort of a tour of what you think of that argument, or the progression of how the Navy was used as sort of a front line for the interests of American corporatism?
Right. It's funny you bring that up, because I don't talk about it that much in the book, and which is doubly ironic, because I've served in the Navy, so I do care and know about these things. I just didn't happen to bring it up as much. But by the time I focus on it, it's into the era of the real Pacific expansion, so the debate over Hawaii and then the Spanish-American War, and the sense that this is what great nations do. So Alfred Thayer Mahan in 1890 sort of fashions a narrative around American greatness that requires the United States, now that it has essentially consolidated its control over the territory, the contiguous continent, how can it achieve greatness? What's the next step? And the next logical step, as far as he is concerned, using Great Britain as his model, is naval expansion, is to spread the power of the United States Navy well beyond the shores, right? This isn't just about, and this gets to your point about using the Navy as a vehicle for opening markets. Well, this is in an era in which markets are closed, or they are privileged. There's a privileged access for the various empires that sort of carve out these blocks under mercantilism and sort of, if not completely exclude others from trading there, at least set the terms of trade so that it's just so it's such a great advantage to them and a disadvantage to everyone else. And so the United States, I think, for part of this period, felt compelled to play that game along the same terms. But there was also, and then this started to evolve in England as well, there was starting to be sort of erosion of this sense that that's how you become wealthy, is by closing off access to others. In fact, there was a greater desire, I think, among many people to break open these various trading blocks. But of course, that wouldn't happen for a very, very long time. So mostly what I focus on in the book is the territorial expansion that came around the time of the Spanish-American War in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But you're absolutely right that there's another part of the story which I don't talk about as much, which is the relationship between the Navy and commercial interests trading around the world.
Now, before we leave the subject, I just have to note that, once again, the horrible John C. Calhoun was always a fan of building up the Navy and dredging waterways and using government resources to improve rivers and harbors, mainly because it was in the Southern interests and the interests of slaveholders to bring their crops to market. The next stage of that is just pushing the Navy out to bombard coastlines in other countries. And now, speaking of things that great nations do, I was discussing this with somebody at a conference recently, that I believe it was under Grover Cleveland that the United States participated in the Berlin Conference that partitioned Africa and recognized King Leopold's Belgian Congo.
Right.
Which killed about 12 million Africans, all told, I believe, producing rubber eventually. I mean, that
misery.
Producing
misery mostly, but yes.
The person I was talking to was like, well, what was he supposed to do? I mean, you know, that's sort of...
That's the way it was
that's
done.
That's what presidents do, right? Right? You can't really fault him for that too much.
I mean, Cleveland, I know a bit about him and I've learned more about him, you know, doing this work. You're right. I think that what was the alternative? The United States wanted to be a player on the global stage. And one of the ways you did that was participate in these sorts of dialogues. And there's only so much you could do in sort of pushing it in a different direction, it seems to me. So I guess you could, with any American president, frankly, you could pull out examples that in retrospect don't look very pleasant. And I agree, this is one of the, certainly not one of the more pleasant aspects of Cleveland's career. But at other times, I think his position with respect to Hawaii is a commendable one. And he resisted for lots of different reasons. And he also was much more committed to principles of free trade than were fashionable at the time. So I guess it's a more than mixed bag. I think he's one of the better ones in that period.
You know, now that I think about it, it might have been just before his presidency. But either one, whether it was him or his predecessor, it's that whole era of foreign policy and these sorts of events get overlooked because exactly what you said, that, there's this sense that, well, this is just sort of how a great nation acts.
Yeah,
and
right,
if we're moving,
right.
if we're in this great transition from a second-rate power... That's scrapping with the British for our own existence, trying to get up to that great power status. I mean, this is just the sort of thing you have to do. You have to go to big international conferences like this and at least participate,
right?
Make an appearance,
right?
And as I recall, there was plenty of arm twisting going on and whining and dining of the American delegates to get their support,
get their buy-in,
and. Yeah. This then leads me into our final document for the week here, which comes from William Graham Sumner, this famous essay of his on the conquest of the United States by Spain. And, he was certainly horrified at what it means to be a great power.
Right.
To give us some background on Sumner.
Well, very much in along the lines of what we just said. I mean, Sumner... Speaking at a time the Spanish-American War has occurred, so this is January of 1899, and the war ends quickly, and then the United States is suddenly sort of thrust into this status as we have graduated to great power status. We have sort of conferred this death blow, it appears, to the Spanish Empire, which was sort of decrepit by that stage anyway. And this speech is sort of a cry, that we do not make ourselves great in the way that the empires of the past made themselves great by lording over other peoples. That's just not how it's done. And it's a remarkable speech because there are so many elements of it that are so resonant even today. There are passages that would sound so familiar to anyone who sort of looked at American foreign policy over the last 20 years and asked themselves, how did we get here? And I think that's exactly what Sumner was saying in 1899. How did we get here? What happened to us as a people that we forgot what it was that actually made this country special and unique? And now we are just simply adopting the same principles of greatness that we rejected for much of our history.
The conquest of the United States by Spain. I have no doubt that the conservative classes of this country will yet look back with great regret to their acquiescence in the events of 1898 and the doctrines and precedents which have been silently established. Let us be well assured that self-government is not a matter of flags and 4th of July orations, nor yet of strife to get offices. Eternal vigilance is the price of that as of every other political good. The perpetuity of self-government depends on the sound political sense of the people, and sound political sense is a matter of habit and practice. We can give it up, and we can take instead pomp and glory. This is what Spain did. She had as much self-government as any country in Europe at the beginning of the 16th century. The union of the smaller states into one big one gave an impulse to her national feeling and national development. The discovery of America put into her hands the control of immense territories. National pride and ambition were stimulated. Then came the struggle with France for world dominion, which resulted in absolute monarchy and bankruptcy for Spain. She lost self-government and saw her resources spent on interests which were foreign to her, but she could talk about an empire in which the sun never set and boast of her colonies, her gold mines, her fleets and armies and debts. She had glory and pride, mixed, of course, with defeat and disaster, such as must be experienced by any nation on that course of policy. And she grew weaker in her industry and commerce, and poorer in the status of the population all the time. She has never been able to recover real self-government yet. If we Americans believe in self-government, why do we let it slip away from us? Why do we barter it away for military glory as Spain did? There is not a civilized nation which does not talk about its civilizing mission just as grandly as we do. The English, who really have more to boast of in this respect than anybody else, talk least about it. But the Pharisaism with which they correct and instruct other people has made them hated all over the globe. The French believe themselves the guardians of the highest and purest culture, and that the eyes of all mankind are fixed on Paris, whence they expect oracles of thought and taste. The Germans regard themselves as charged with a mission, especially to us Americans, to save us from egoism and materialism. The Russians, in their books and newspapers, talk about the civilizing mission of Russia in language that might be translated from some of the finest paragraphs in our imperialistic newspapers. The first principle of Mohammedanism is that we Christians are dogs and infidels, fit only to be enslaved or butchered by Muslims. It is a corollary that wherever Mohammedanism extends, it carries in the belief of its votaries the highest blessings, and that the whole human race would be enormously elevated if Mohammedanism should supplant Christianity everywhere. To come last to Spain, the Spaniards have for centuries considered themselves the most zealous and self-sacrificing Christians, especially charged by the Almighty on this account to spread true religion and civilization over the globe. They think themselves free and noble leaders in refinement and the sentiments of personal honor, and they despise us as sordid money-grabbers and heretics. I could bring you passages from peninsular authors of the first rank about the grand role of Spain and Portugal in spreading freedom and truth. Now each nation laughs at all the others when it observes these manifestations of national vanity. You may rely upon it that they are all ridiculous by virtue of these pretensions, including ourselves. The point is that each of them repudiates the standards of the others, and the outlying nations which are to be civilized hate all the standards of civilized men. We assume that what we like in practice and what we think better must come as a welcome blessing to Spanish Americans and Filipinos. This is grossly and obviously untrue. They hate our ways. They are hostile to our ideas. Our religion, language, institutions, and manners offend them. They like their own ways, and if we appear amongst them as rulers, there will be social discord in all the great departments of social interest. The most important thing which we shall inherit from the Spaniards will be the task of suppressing rebellions. If the United States takes out of the hands of Spain her mission, on the ground that Spain is not executing it well, and if this nation in its turn attempts to be schoolmistress to others, it will shrivel up into the same vanity and self-conceit of which Spain now presents an example. To read our current literature, one would think that we were already well on the way to it. Now the great reason why all these enterprises which begin by saying to somebody else, "We know what is good for you better than you know yourself, and we're going to make you do it," are false and wrong is that they violate liberty, or to turn the same statement into other words, the reason why liberty, of which we Americans talk so much, is a good thing, is that it means leaving people to live out their own lives in their own way, while we do the same. If we believe in liberty as an American principle, why do we not stand by it? Why are we going to throw it away to enter upon a Spanish policy of dominion and regulation?
And that's where we'll pick up next week. Our greatest thanks to Chris Preble, who has a PhD in history from Temple University. And be sure to check out his latest book, this one published right here at libertarianism.org, Peace, War, and Liberty: Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. Thanks for listening. Liberty Chronicles is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Liberty Chronicles, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.